I'm Christopher Lydon, getting a personal take on the new India that we haven't heard before from a young man who went home from Ohio to the land of his ancestors and ran into the feeling in India that, hey, your party in America is over and you may be too late for the party underway in Bombay. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, with Anand Giridharadas of the New York Times, born in Ohio, educated in Michigan, child of that wave of immigration that brought India's best and brightest out of a bad time back home in the 1970s to the land of milk, honey, high tech, and opportunity in America. When Anand returned to do his bit in the mother country, he found not his parents stifled old India, but a swarming entrepreneurial frontier, more modern, more gung-ho in many ways than the American Midwest he grew up in. Do I get it right, Anand? Is that the idea?
That's right. I think a lifetime of family conversations in America about what India was, a lifetime of biannual visits to India had created a kind of picture of what India was. It was, of course, not the country itself. It was an image of the country.
Sketch those two images, your parents' India as you knew it as a little kid and now India.
I think the India that had kind of congealed in my mind from those stories and those fleeting visits was a place that was very kind and generous and decent, filled with hospitality and love. But a place in which people didn't quite become the fullest expressions of themselves. There was a kind of restrained quality to life. People didn't ask much, demand much, hope for much. There was a lot of acceptance, serene acceptance. The India I found a quarter century later might as well have been another country in many ways. It was a place whose entrepreneurial capitalistic energies now exceeded in many ways those of the United States. It was a place where people saw where they were born as a springboard now to other places they might go, not as a commandment to stay in a particular place. It was a place where the idea of destiny, fate, karma, whatever you call it, was no longer, frankly, respected. It had been the most important idea for so many generations of Indians, all the way up. And now suddenly people had a sense that karma was like a piece of advice, but nothing more.
That's amazing. Put that in the terms of your father's life or your mother's or
well, I'll give you one very vivid example of my father's life. One of the reasons he left, none of us leave countries for massive geopolitical reasons. We ultimately leave for personal reasons. His personal reason, his personal situation was working in the 1970s for a company called Tata Motors, selling their trucks and buses in Africa. And all he could do to make a judgment about whether he wanted to be in India long term was look around him at work. And I will never forget the simple way in which he describes why he decided to leave. He said he looked at his bosses, 20 years ahead of him in line, and concluded he didn't want to spend his life becoming them. Now, fast forward a quarter century. Tata Motors is today that same stagnant, dead company that couldn't convince that in some ways pushed my father out of the country as a whole, is today one of the most admired car companies in the world. Why? Because it no longer only sells, although it still does, rickety trucks and buses in Africa. It has also now made the world's cheapest car for about $2,000 in an engineering feat that has wowed every major automaker. And when I was a reporter in India, I spoke to auto executives at American and Japanese and European car manufacturers who were scratching their heads saying, how the hell did these people do this?
And the answer is?
Well, the answer is they made a trunk the size of a small laptop bag, and they had only one windshield wiper instead of two, and they innovated. But the same...
Did they have help from some Indian who'd gone to Stanford or MIT or worked in Silicon Valley?
They did. In fact, they did. They had one Indian engineer. I'm not sure his precise role in the project, but he spent many years in GM and came back. But I'll tell you, so there are two ways to think about it. One is to say they did have that kind of expertise. They had consultants and advisors who had certainly come back from the West. But here's another interpretation of what was different. In my father's, the constraints in some ways were the same. They still essentially had a billion poor people around them. That was not particularly changed. They still had engineering constraints. They still had a government that's not particularly helpful to what business does. But in my father's day, I think most Indians would have interpreted that context I described as essentially hindering progress and being an excuse for producing suboptimal stuff. So it would be an excuse to say, you know, our government's like this, our poverty is like this, we can only produce a terrible bus. The new language is we have unique hardships, which gives us a unique opportunity to create globally competitive products that are better than anybody else's products. Because our roads are bumpier, our suspension systems have to be even better than the American suspension systems. Because people are poor in this country, we need to work twice as hard to bring the price point of a car down to $2,000. It's the same context in a way. It's just a different way of looking at it.
Because the world is poor, because there are potholes everywhere.
There are 3 billion people who would be very excited about a $2,000 car.
Is there a mother story to match your dad's?
You know, her story was less about professional life and work and more about private life. Although, as she always reminds me, she didn't choose to leave. She left because my father left and followed him and learned to love it. But it was not her original idea. What I can say is for her, I think when she did reach America, she was activated as a person in a way that would have been inconceivable in India. And sometimes she's reluctant to say this because she loves India and she perhaps wouldn't put it in the same language that I would. But I think it's obvious to anybody external who sees her. She's become an artist. She has a style of dressing, a way of talking that I think if I look at her cousins, there was just less self-making. She has clearly found a path to invent herself as her own person. And in India, you can do many things. You could do many things in her day. I think the one thing that you couldn't really do was construct yourself from your own imagination.
So you grow up in the malls and the little leagues and the high schools of Shaker Heights, upper middle class, Cleveland suburb, and you're a hybrid by now of culture and also skills that are going to be everywhere one of these days and may rule the world if we're lucky. Describe the split screen in your own head now, Anand.
You know, there's in some ways before and after having lived in India over the last 6 years. Before, I think the split screen was a quite strong certainty that America was reality and a total reality. And being Indian was a kind of also. And it was small stuff that made us different. So we weren't allowed to really play like football. We could kind of play swimming, go swimming and play tennis. We ate slightly different food, but then sometimes ate the same food as everybody else. It was just small differences in values, in culture. I think having now spent the last 6 years there, in some ways it reinforced feelings of being American because I realized some of the things that I take for granted as an American that are not present in India, and it strengthened my conviction that those things are important and that I value them. I think on the other hand, it really relativized my sense of home, and I've come away with a strong sense that many things needn't just be one way, and that the Indian way is, if not entirely my way on particular things, a very important source of inspiration for how I think through a whole variety of things in life. When I first moved to India 6 years ago, if I had a business trip, I was in Bombay, if I had a business trip to Delhi, I would either decide whether I wanted to see my grandparents who lived in Delhi on that trip, or if I had friends to see and other things to do. And the Indian thing to do is, regardless of what you have to do, go stay with your grandparents, at least call them, spend time with them. But I saw it in a very American way. I have my stuff to do. If I could see them, I'd go see them. If I couldn't, I wouldn't even tell them I was in Delhi, because telling them was raise way more expectations. By the time I left 6 years later, I would never do that. If I went to Delhi, I would call them. If I couldn't see them, I wouldn't see them. But I made much more effort to see them. I think in some ways that you realize in India that it's not about you. And I think when you grow up in this country, the idea that it's not about you comes as a bit of a shock.
And then describe that shock that you've written about of getting to India and discovering that they weren't just waiting for this modern American guy to tell them about life, but a kind of brushback that, wait a sec, you missed the new revolution. It's here. You're late. Maybe you shouldn't have left. What are you doing here?
You know, it was funny because everything that had happened prior to my moving there, in childhood, in my teenage years, had prepared me for the idea that there would be great enthusiasm for people of my background moving back. Our cousins kind of looked up to us as people, as the keepers of amazing secrets about the West and scandalous romantic deeds. And, you know, they start asking when you're 11 years old, do you have a girlfriend? And you have to kind of make up that you did to satisfy them. And we used to bring back peanut butter and mayonnaise and things like this in our suitcases for them. And all of this kind of fed this idea that they welcomed our presence. We brought them tales from the land of milk and honey, as they often called it. By the time I went back, which is about 12 years, depending on how you count, after the time that India really started to open to the world, open its markets, embrace globalization, etc. That kind of, whether you call it insecurity or neediness or even simply admiration, was gone. I can't think of any examples I encountered from 2003 onward, living in Bombay, when anyone was particularly excited by the fact that I was from somewhere else. And partly this was a bit of a jolt. Where I was working at McKinsey, there was a kind of almost blitheness about India being the new center, and of course someone like me was coming there. And at a deeper level, although it may have been a little surprising on the surface, at a deeper level, you couldn't but feel very happy for a country that didn't feel like it needed you anymore.
You mentioned the liberalization of 1991. It escaped most of us, I think, that a radical shift was underway. The opening up of the Indian economy, as big a change as Deng Xiaoping's market capitalism in China, except I didn't notice it.
It's true. And what's really interesting about that, there are a few interesting things about that. Number one, you're right that 1978 in China is a global milestone. 1991 in India, people barely know. And yet, people forget that when China in 1978 opened up, in between, in the intervening decades, they had drastically suppressed capitalism. They'd had revolutions, etc. When India opened up the economy, you have to remember, it had never had revolutions of that kind. And so in some ways, the animal spirits of capitalism in India didn't need to be, didn't take much time to reawaken. Indians are very naturally capitalistic. And in many ways, a few decades of Nehru was a powerful elite, you know, Fabian socialist fantasy about what Indians were.
You've got to unfold all of that. The fundamental inherent capitalism. I think Gandhi may have embraced it more than Nehru, but you suggest between the lines, it seems to me, that there was a certain kind of disease holding India down and back through those years. That one of the great civilizations of the world had been trapped in a box. You write, no one questioned, no one dreamed, nothing moved. Why not?
I think you have to contrast the nature of the society with the nature of the economy. So those words applied in some ways to both spheres in those decades. but it applied to the economic sphere only to the extent that the government had prevented anything from moving. Indians themselves, at a street level, never longed much for the kind of suppression of wealth that you had in the Nehru era. Indians are born moneymakers. When I talk about nothing moving, the stagnancy, it was more a social stagnancy. It was more the idea that every generation's purpose is to stretch forward the legacy of the last generation, one generation more. That the best thing you can do as a son is be like your father, do his job or a job like it, maybe even repeat the same jokes, maybe even live in the same house, maybe marry a wife just like your mother. The idea of self-invention, which I think in this country we take for granted, is in some ways the very opposite of that idea.
What do you mean, though, that India is naturally, inherently a capitalist society?
When socialism was posed on India after independence in 1947, a certain segment of the population bought into it. But that was a relatively elite class of people who felt the intellectual justification for we are a very poor country, we need to redistribute. At a street level, if you go to a village, if you go to a urban slum, it's not like going to the bleak villages or slums of the United States or of France, for example. The slums and the villages in India are more entrepreneurial than other parts of India. They're the most entrepreneurial parts of India. The slums are not hives of unemployment the way they are in this country. They're the opposite. It's the parts where people will come from the village, pay $20,000 for like half a room, find a way to recoup the $20,000 on a 80% interest rate, selling whatever they can find, finding watches in the trash can, taking them apart, selling the parts, recycling. I mean, these are people who really don't look for government to do anything for them. In the way when you talk about, in this country's political debates, you talk about a welfare state and people who live off welfare and just expect the government to do everything for them. Whether or not that exists, in India I never found people like that. I never met anybody, and for good reason, who expected the government to do anything for them. Even though the government does do a lot of welfare stuff with varying degrees of success. Fundamentally, people accept the idea of needing to make money. What they didn't accept was the idea of having to change and the possibility of being able to change their status.
Come back to the point that on your re-entry to India, about 5-6 years ago, you found India in this surge of growth not becoming westernized, but in some strange way becoming more itself, more indigenous. How does that play?
I mean, it's interesting to think about the ways in which it's becoming both. So if your measure is more superficial, it's becoming more westernized. Clearly, the content of what people watch on television is substantially more Western than it was 10 years ago. The fact that people watch satellite television, the fact they have satellite television, more people now drive cars, which are a Western invention, than walk on the street. The economy is a completely globalized phenomenon, which in many cases means people working in Western industries for Western companies. And yet the opposite is happening in a different way. It's happening more at the level of the soul, you could say. People, there's a growing comfort in simply being Indian. There's a growing sense that people don't need to locate their hearts and minds halfway outside the country to feel cool, proud, competent. So the same guy who is working for IBM in Bangalore is in some ways part of a westernization of the country. In other ways, I think you'd find him less insecure about being Indian, more likely to listen to Indian music, more likely to eat Indian food without any pretenses to do it with a fork and knife. And so there's a kind of contradictoriness there, but in some ways there's a liberation of spirit that both of those things share. It is a person coming into their own, and that coming into one's own frees them to embrace certain things about the West that are of more use to them, and frees them at the same time to embrace certain parts of the past that earlier generations might have felt embarrassed by.
Can you sketch a person in that place?
There was two people who capture this for me very well. They were born around the same time in first half of the 20th century. My grandfather, my mother's father, and a completely different man named Dhirubhai Ambani, who ended up becoming the great hero of Indian capitalism, the richest man in India. His son is today the richest man in India.
With the skyscraper house in Bombay.
Exactly. And the two, these two men from the same merchant caste, both started out with the same situation, which is their fathers had both deviated from being merchants. They were professionals. Ambani's father was a school teacher, and my grandfather's father was a lawyer. And so they both faced a choice: continue in this kind of deviation from the money-making merchant caste, or kind of revert to the ways of the caste. Now, if you were taking a snapshot in the 40s when they were making their decisions, it was a time of Nehru, Gandhi, this idea of nation building and forget profit. Profit was very East India Company. It was associated with colonialism. And there was this new idea of public purpose, public spirit, which these leaders were trying to press. And I think if you took a snapshot at that point, it would have seemed that deviating from the merchant path, going in the way of respectability, I think as my grandfather saw it, becoming like a new brown-skinned Englishman to replace the departing white-skinned Englishman was the smart course. And for him, the course that just felt right. And that's what he did. He became a professional. He left merchantness for good. When my mother was born, he took away the merchant caste name and gave her his middle name as her last name. Became like English people, watched how the English people in his company behaved and learned to eat like them, dress like them, wore tweed his whole life, never really seen him wearing Indian clothes, and as a really sophisticated, worldly, well-traveled, cosmopolitan Indian, and an Indian in many ways very removed from what his country is like outside the walls of his bungalow. Dhirubhai Ambani made a completely opposite choice, which in that day would have seemed a very weird choice. He had showed little interest in the kind of respectability of the school teacher's respectability his father had and went back to being a merchant. Went to Yemen, apprenticed there, worked for an oil company, came back, started selling spices from the bazaar in Bombay back to contacts in Aden. A classic Indian merchant, meeting people, having tea with them, getting a deal. And slowly, over 60 years, my grandfather's India has shriveled in a way. And Dhirubhai Ambani's India, which is ruthless, money-grabbing, efficient, concerned with the reality of what India is, not an idealized, colonized portraiture of it, has won. And it's an India that my grandfather still lives in, but now finds much less familiar to him. It's an India that he finds, to speak from his vantage point, corrupt, uncouth, kind of concerned with money and nothing else. But it's the India that has prevailed.
Mm. And how does your own heart land in that difference?
At a surface level, my grandfather is a more familiar figure the way he is because he's halfway to the West. I mean, he's more comfortable in English than any other language. He wears Western clothes. I mean, there's almost the cultural difference is substantially reduced. But in another way, although in some ways it was not my family's India, the India that has risen is an India that one can be really excited about, because it's an India closer to the soil and an India without any angst about being Indian. And you can see that in kind of cultural psychological terms, in terms of, for example, when my parents were teenagers, no one wanted to listen to Indian music in the discos. Today, if you go to a disco in Bombay, it's Bollywood music. If you play one Western song, the dance floor clears. No one thinks that's cool anymore. They think their own culture is cool. But it also translates into economic stuff. So if you took the company my grandfather worked for, which was Hindustan Lever, part of the global Unilever enterprise, they operated in a world in which the government controlled supply. So they couldn't, everyone was guaranteed a certain number of customers. You didn't have to worry about constantly expanding your markets. So they sold soap and shampoo and things to a certain sliver of the Indian elite. They didn't worry about anybody else, right? And 900 million Indians, or however many hundred millions there were at the time, didn't have the benefits of an ingenious company like Unilever worrying about how to clean their hair and brush their teeth. If you look at the company that Dhirubhai Ambani built, everything has changed. It's not just, that's not the only variable. It's cultural, but also the government doesn't control supply anymore, etc. It's a company, like many Indian companies today, obsessed not with selling soap to the elite, but with how to sell to a billion Indians, how to sell them energy, how to sell them oil, how to create cell phone networks that can give them calls for, you know, 1 cent a minute. No one's saying they're doing this out of benevolence. In fact, they're in many ways more corrupt and questionable in their practices than a company like Unilever ever was. But at their core, they are concerned with the Indian problems of India in a way that earlier generation of companies wasn't, because they didn't have to be.
You know, another one of those Ambani scale moguls, the founder of Infosys, Narayana Murthy, was here the other night at Brown. Mr. Bangalore, Mr. Indian Information Technology, he said the sun never sets now, not on the British Empire, but on the extensions of Indian software. And of course, he's right. But I'm not sure he answered the question how information technology with a workforce of 2 million Indians is going to lift the tide for a country with hundreds and hundreds of millions of poor people, a billion altogether, in which 2 million IT workers is, you know, a fragment of 1% of the country.
The simple answer is it won't. 2 million jobs will not drag 700 million people out of poverty. The more complex answer is that once you tell 2 million people in a society, and everybody who can see them, which is a lot more people, that some people in our society, and not kings and queens, ordinary people who just worked hard, can now work in the best industries in the world, can design the software that powers Boeing cockpits, can answer emergency phone calls for the best companies in the world. Once you send that idea out in the society, it's very hard to recork the ambition that spills over. So the real effect of those 2 million people is almost like an advertisement. Think of them as a big advertisement for what the other 700 million can, or the other billion can be. They are an advertisement for the fact that the old days of stagnancy are over. Now, there's a lot of spillover effect. I mean, there's the kind of trickle-down. They make a lot of money, which then they go spend in malls, and someone has to be standing in the malls selling them T-shirts. So a lot of jobs that come with that. But I think the real power, what you see now in India, is if you drive out of Delhi, you drive out of Bombay, you'll notice as you enter the villages, the first kind of hour entering the villages, that you start seeing these little huts, kind of semi-concrete, semi-huts. And they are these finishing schools, hole-in-the-wall little academies that for $20, $25, $40 will sell a skill, English, electrician's training, things like this.
In an afternoon?
In 2 weeks, 3 weeks, three months, whatever. This is everywhere in India now. I didn't see this 10 years ago. Today, it's like the dominant site in the landscape is these little, you know, completely unregulated, usually very low quality, you know, schools. What has happened is word has gotten out about those 2 million people, and 50 more million people want to become like them. And a lot of them are going to try, and they're not going to get a job in the IT industry. But then they're going to figure out what else to do, and they're going to go do it. And I think if anything, the IT industry has simply catalyzed ambition and persuaded the world that India has to be taken seriously and persuaded Indians that they are to be taken seriously by the world.
Come back to Mumbai, Bombay. You quote somebody's guesstimate that 30 new migrants come into Mumbai every minute of the day. And this push-pack express train is one symbol of the wave. You've been on it, the train that crosses India from the northeast toward the south and west. Put us on it and show us around.
It starts in Lucknow, in Uttar Pradesh, which is India's most populous state. If you walk around in Bombay and you ask any migrant on the street, the guy polishing shoes, the guy sleeping on his taxi, where do you come from? They all come from Uttar Pradesh. It's one of the poorest, bleakest states in India. And Bombay is New York for them. And so I decided to go to where they originate and to retrace their journey with them to Bombay and see what it looks like through their eyes. So I got on the train. It's a $6 ride for a 24-hour train ride from Lucknow to Bombay. And on the train, you essentially have this interstitial space between the villages they are leaving and the city to which they're heading. And you see hints of both aboard the train. The city is about ambition, about this new dream of self-making. And you see these strivers on the train. You see people, I met people who have gone back 20 times, bringing relatives with them, bringing money home. I met people who've started, you know, sleeping in a bakery for a year and now own a small business of their own. People who went thinking they would be in Bollywood movies and are now, you know, valets in a restaurant. One guy said to me, dreams don't go away in Bombay, they just get smaller. You also see these reminders that for all this new urbanness, for these 31 people showing up in an Indian city every minute, which is a figure from Goldman Sachs, so perhaps we should all discount it slightly now, the train itself offers so many reminders of the old India before it becomes this urban society, anonymous society. It was very striking, these people heading to Bombay who are going to be completely lost in the crowd in 20 more hours. While they're on the train, it's like a new village. I mean, they're not each other's villagers. They're from different villages, but they become their own village on the train. Their feet are across each other. They're leaning on each other's bags. Their seats are completely interchangeable, and no one minds. No one complains. No one has a concept of this is my space, this is your space. People were resting on each other, sleeping on each other's seats. And looking at that, I just had the sense that this was that effortless involvement of people in each other's lives was precisely the world they were fleeing, which is also a very poor, impoverished world. And the world they were entering would eventually not be like that at all. There were vendors throughout the 24 hours. At every station, vendors came on. Beggars came on. Sometimes eunuchs, dancing eunuchs came on, kind of harassing you to extort you for money. None of this happens in the other compartments on the train. It all happens on third class. So the only people begged from are the poor people. The rich people are protected from beggars and hawkers coming on so aggressively. But the most fascinating vendor of all was the tea vendor. These were, you know, maybe 14-year-old boys or something like this. And I remember this boy with neatly parted hair standing on the The open doorways, again, third-class trains don't have doors, closing doors. Standing in the doorway of the train with this massive vat on his hip of scalding tea, and then suddenly jumping out of the door. And if you didn't know better, you would think it was a very unfortunate situation. But in fact, he was just flinging himself onto the outside of the train. He knew every rod and bump on the train's exterior, and skated from one to the next, and essentially climbed into the next compartment. And the reason for that is all the second and first class compartments are internally connected through doorways, the way trains are around the world. But in third class, almost in an echo of the caste regimes of their village that these people wanted to get away from, the compartments were sealed off physically from the other other compartments. And if you wanted to sell tea, you needed to risk your life every time and go around the outside.
Three questions about this new India, Anand. The social cohesion of this place, but also the macro politics of it, and then the culture of this new India. All brand new, it seems. What holds this completely churned up, urbanized, changed social culture together? What did the people who get to Bombay have in common in the end?
I think that's an important question that has yet to be fully answered. But I think one thing that's very interesting and somewhat unique to India and a globalization model that is not the familiar narrative about how globalization works is that Indians seem much more excited to rebel in the economic sphere than in the social sphere. And what I mean by that is there's a real impatience now with being told you belong to a certain station in life and have to stay there. When it comes to hierarchy, there's a real impatience. There's a rejection of place. When it comes to things like family attachments, conceptions of what love is and isn't, Indians are in some ways much less defiant. The old plays a much more important role in the new India when it comes to matters of love and marriage, for example, than it does in deciding whether people get a much better job than their parents did. And in some ways, this is surprising and frustrating. I mean, you see, to go back to Infosys, where Mr. Murthy works, if you speak to a lot of the men there, you'll find they're ambitious, they're daring, they've taken great risks to be there. But if you probe them on their ideas about women, whether they truly have enlightened themselves about the other sex in the way that they've enlightened themselves about software, I think you'll often find the answer is no. But in a strange way, I think the relative slowness of social rupture compared to economic rupture is holding the country together, because everything is not new. It's more hierarchy, place, rank in the economy that is new. People have not entirely shed the social past.
Politically speaking, what has taken place of the Nehru socialism, the Gandhi socialism of India in its first 50 years?
I mean, I think both those men would be mortified, to put it very frankly. They'd be excited at the frequency of mentions of India on the front pages of newspapers around the world, but I think that's it. I think in many ways the country that has resulted is completely different than the country that they dreamed of.
Jefferson would be shocked in our country too, so that's okay.
A great Indian historian, Ram Guha, made that very point in his recent history book, India After Gandhi. He said, perhaps democracies require extraordinary founders and then only, mediocre captains to continue steering the ship.
So what is the politics today, even when the Hindu nationalists are not in power? How would you describe the kind of governing rules?
India's a place of extraordinary contestation if you zoom in and are in the thick of it, if you sit in parliament and watch what happens. I think if you zoom out, there's actually an extraordinary degree of consensus right now, despite rhetoric on the general trajectory, which has actually not been reversed since 1991, of a gradual, careful, on our own terms, opening to the world, a gradual opening of markets with a strong reserved right not to open them when it doesn't make sense. And essentially, overhanging all of that, a gradual shift in the locus of energy and activity in the country from government to the private sector. This is not happening in India, all of this, because the government has done really great stuff. It's happening because it got out of the business of imagining that it could do really great stuff and let, you know, 99% of the society who didn't work for the government do their really great stuff. And that's when you started to have all this energy and drive and talent unleashed.
Finally, I'm puzzling about the culture of India, the land of the sitar, great classical musical tradition, literary traditions, art traditions.
In some ways, that's one of the sadder things that's happening, although I think it's not uncommon in this globalizing era. What you have in India right now is so much energy. It's almost as if tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people were these aluminum cans that were just shaken for 1,000 years. And now all these cans are being opened. And you know what happens when you shake an aluminum can for 1,000 years. And that's beautiful if your metric of the good society is a place that works hard, invents great stuff, creates $2,000 cars, does software coding for IBM, makes the software for cockpit doors. If your metrics are different metrics, if they are tolerance, if they are the production of great literature that reflects the soul of the people, if they are a strong, vibrant press that actually keeps powerful people honest, a variety of the things that don't fall under the narrow kind of very commercial definition of the good society. I don't know how well India is doing. I think there's a great sense of energy without a sense of why. There's a lot of how right now in India. There's not a lot of why. And that's okay when you're a poor country with little consequence in the world. When you're one of the biggest oil consumers in the world, as India now is, suddenly your ethical system matters a lot to the world. It can finance genocides or end them. Your idea of whether the environment is something that should be saved and whether it's your problem or not your problem is, again, very, very, very important to the world. And what I sometimes worry about, although there are definitely signs to the contrary, I worry that the culture is now dominated by 1,000 private ambitions and with very little sense of the whole.
Rana Dasgupta, who's a bit of an English version of you, he went back to the land of his parents and writes now from Delhi, not Mumbai, but he describes a place consumed both by euphoria and dread, with a dominant mood of frenzied accumulation, he writes, and a vast gap between grueling poverty and a vampire ruling class. I mean, can this go on?
That's fair, but I also think that ignores how much there is in the middle. In some ways, I don't think the story of India is... there have always been vampires. They were once called maharajas and landlords, and they've always been the grueling poverty of the countryside. I think what's new is all the people who have realized that you don't have to be born a maharaja to become one and who are crossing that river. And it's a relatively small trickle on the scale of a billion. But as any software coder in the United States knows, it's enough to shake up the entire world when people start to cross that river.
Anand, thank you. Take us on one of your forays. But in the meantime, it's wonderful to read you on the Times website, and I look forward to the book coming from Times Books in January. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation with Anand Giridharadas. His book will be out in January. Feedback, please, with your own memories and fantasies of India coming and going, and link to other conversations we're having in this Year of India at Brown University at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.